Okay, so tonight I'm going to read chapter 6 from The Island, the anthology on Nibbana by Ajahn Pasno and Ajahn Amaro. There's a lot of Pali in here, so I'll probably be selective whether I read all the Pali or not. Atamayata, not made of that. As the final part of our investigation into the conditioned world, we will take a look at Atamayata, a term from the Pali canon that has become somewhat obscure over the centuries. However, it defines a quality crucial to the realization of spiritual freedom. The word literally means not made of that, but it can be rendered in many different ways, giving it a variety of subtle shades of meaning. Bhikkhu Bodhi and Bhikkhu Nyanamoli render it as non-identification, focusing on the subject side of the equation. Other translators have it as non-fashioning or unconcoctability, thus hinting more at the object dimension of it. Either way, it refers primarily to the quality of experience prior to or without a subject-object duality arising. As described in the comprehensive essay by Bhikkhu Santikaro, which comprises the first of our passages in this chapter, it was Ajahn Buddhadasa who was largely responsible for bringing this term into the public eye in recent years. Although it should also be noted that Bhikkhu Nyanananda, in his influential little book, The Magic of the Mind, first published in 1974, gave the subject of Atamayata significant attention. Ajahn Buddhadasa spent the last 3 or 4 years of his life discoursing on this word, proclaiming it to be the ultimate Buddhist concept. He felt it to be of such significance and subtlety that he placed it at the head of his list of 9 insights, which he saw as comprising all the dimensions of the practice of wisdom. In a play on the Thai word da, meaning I, he described these 9 abodes of contemplation, whose Pali names all end in ta, as being the eyes through which to view the very nature of all experience. Atamayata is described as the final divorce from the deluded sense of I and mine. And this is the selection from Bhikkhu Santikaro, which is like 3 pages long, so I'll let you know when it's done. Atamayata, the rebirth of a lost word. The term Atamayata cannot be found in the Polytech Society Dictionary. Readers will find it difficult to discover references to it in scholarly works, whether they come from West or East. The meditation masters of Tibet, Burma, or Zen do not seem to be interested in it. Mention it to most Buddhists and they will not know what you are talking about. Yet there is clear evidence in the Pali canon that the Buddha gave this word significant meaning. Currently, one of Thailand's most influential monks is teaching that it is the highest word in Buddhism, the final sword of Buddhism. Atamayata appears in a number of Pali suttas, and each context suggests that the term has important meaning. The traditional commentator's standard explanation, although vague, describes it as the awakened state of the arahant, or fully awakened, perfect being. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu from Suan Muk in southern Siam first took note of this word about 30 years ago. The context in which he found Atamayata convinced him that its meaning is important. As with other terms and teachings found in the Tipitaka, he was careful to look further than the orthodox grammarians, pedants, and pundits. He searched for a spiritual meaning on the deepest level possible. We can only speculate as to why Atamayata was left out of the PTS dictionary. Surely not because it is impossible to decipher. A literal analysis gives us not, that, and to make, or create, or produce, and ta, the state of being. Thus, Atamayata may be translated as the state of not being made up by or made up from that thing or that condition. The meaning becomes clear if we recognize that maya is a synonym for sankhara, to concoct, compound, or condition. Atamayata is unconcoctability, a state of mind independent of the objects and conditions of experience. Fully conscious and aware, this mind is not affected by the defilements of greed, anger, and delusion. Thus, the concept is is close in meaning to the adjective visankara, which describes the unconditioned state of nibbana. Clearly, atamyata is something Buddhists should be aware of. Why does Buddhadasa Bhikkhu consider atamyata so important? In Majjhima Nikaya 137, the Buddha describes a spiritual progression carried out by relying on this to give up that. Relying on the pleasure, pain, and equanimity associated with renunciation, one gives up the pleasure and pain associated with worldliness. Relying on singular or one-pointed equanimity, one gives up many-sided or multifaceted equanimity. Relying on atamyata, one gives up the one-pointed equanimity. In this sutta, many-sided equanimity is explained as equanimity towards form, sounds, odors, tastes, touches, and mind objects, which implies the four meditative states known as the rupa jhanas. The single-sided equanimity is explained as equanimity dependent upon the four immaterial absorptions. To more easily understand what this means, we may compare it with the common Buddhist hierarchy of the central, pure material or non-material realms. The ordinary worldling or thickster clings to sensual experiences due to craving for sensual pleasures. One gets free of sensuality by relying on pure materiality, that is, steady concentration upon material objects. Pure materiality is abandoned by relying on the non-material jhana. Finally, these exalted states of consciousness are abandoned through atamyata. In Majjhima Nikaya 113, the Buddha describes qualities of the good person who avoids indulging in and goes beyond the eight jhanas through atamyata. There is liberation from the asava, which is full awakening. The Buddha is reiterating his message that final liberation cannot be found in the temporary peace and bliss of deep meditative states, in any conditioned state or thing, for that matter. Atamyata is given precedence over the most sublime experiences that humanity can attain. Further, atamyata, rather than mystical states, is offered as the means to liberation. Equanimity is the highest of the seven factors of awakening. When the seven factors are developed successfully, they lead to the penetration of the object on which they are focused. Penetration or direct spiritual experience means awakening to and deeply realizing the true nature of things. Yet the above sutta tells us that atamyata takes the spiritual cultivator beyond even equanimity. The Buddha is saying that even equanimity is a state that can be clung to, thus preventing liberation. Atamyata frees equanimity as well as the other six factors and any wholesome dhamma that aids liberation from clinging and grasping. The mind with atamyata is not clinging and grasping. The mind with atamyata is not concocted by and does not rest in any state of mind, all of which are impermanent, undependable, oppressive, uncontrollable, and unownable. That is, void of selfhood. Why does Buddhadasa Bhikkhu call atamyata the last word and final sword of Buddhism? Based on the above interpretation, he puts atamyata at the transition point between the insights into the reality of nature and the insights regarding liberation and the realization of nibbana. He explains this with a list of nine eyes or insights. And there's a list of nine, which I'll read just the English. Insight into impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not selfhood, naturalness, lawfulness, conditionality, voidness, thusness, and then atamyata, unconcoctability. The realization of these facts about the reality of nature leads to the fruits of liberation, which can be described by the following list of insight knowledges. Again, I'll just read the English. Disenchantment, fading away of attachment, quenching of dukkha, release, purity, and nibbana, coolness. The first list of insights describes an active penetration progressively deeper into the reality of conditioned things. The later list describes the results of that realization. The insight of atamyata is the realization that there is no conditioned thing, object, or state that can be depended upon. Contrary to the way we have learned to see things, They are powerless to concoct or affect us. They have no power to make us happy, safe, free from death, or whatever else we might desire. Then why get concocted by them through foolishly relying upon them? From this realization, liberation naturally follows. Atamyata is a way of understanding the reality of conditioned things. When insight progressively deepens through the nine eyes, then one realizes that there is nothing deserving of being concocted, affected, manipulated, or cooked and seasoned by us. By cultivating this understanding, human beings may liberate themselves from ignorance, from their attachments, from conflict and misery. The third and highest use of atamyata is to signify the state of mind that is totally free, independent, and liberated. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu prefers to describe this state as being above and beyond positive or negative. Human beings instinctually feel and perceive all experience as either positive or negative. This leads to evaluating and judging those experiences, which turns into liking and disliking those experiences, which in turn fosters craving, attachment, and selfishness. Thus arises dukkha. The mind that has gone beyond positive and negative cannot be pulled into the conditioned arising of dukkha. Thus, atamyata, in this its most proper sense, describes the reality of the arahant, the worthy, undefiled one. And that's the end of the Santikara Bhikkhu passage. The references to atamyata in the Pali Canon are few. Here are the two above quoted passages from the Majjhima Nikaya as examples. A person who is not truly good enters and remains in the first jhana. They notice, I have gained the attainment of first jhana. They exalt themselves for that attainment of first jhana, and they disparage others. This is the quality of a person who is not truly good. The truly good person notices, the Blessed One has spoken of non-identification, even with regard to the attainment of the first jhana. For however they conceive it, the fact is ever other than that. So, making non-identification their focal point, they neither exalt themselves for that attainment of the first jhana, nor do they disparage others. This is the quality of a person who is truly good. And then similarly through all the jhanas. So the phrase, for however they conceive it, the fact is ever other than that, is a very famous and much discussed phrase in Theravada literature. It appears in a number of places in the canon. The Pali original is yena yena hi manyanti tato tang hoti anyata ti, discussed extensively in Concept and Reality by Bhikkhu Nyanananda. And this is Majjhima Nikaya 137. And what bhikkhus is equanimity that is unified based on unity. There is equanimity regarding the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of no-thingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhus is equanimity that is unified based on unity. Here, bhikkhus, by depending and relying on equanimity that is unified based on unity, abandon and surmount equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. It is thus this is abandoned, it is thus this is surmounted. Bhikkhus, by depending and relying on non-identification, abandon and surmount equanimity that is unified, based on unity. It is thus this is abandoned, it is thus this is surmounted. So it was in reference to this that it was said, by depending on this, abandon that. To help develop a clear sense of what this term is pointing to, it might be helpful to explore its etymology a little more deeply. And this is a passage from Richard Gumbridge. In the Vedanta, to be wholly and exclusively aware of Brahman was at the same time to be Brahman. The origins of this idea seem to lie in a theory of sense perception in which the grasping hand supplies a dominant analogy. It takes the shape of whatever it apprehends. Vision was similarly explained. The eye sends out some kind of ray which takes the shape of what we see and comes back with it. Similarly, thought. A thought conforms to its object. This idea is encapsulated in the term tamayata, consisting of that. The thought of the Gnostic or meditator becomes consubstantial with the thing realized. That is to say, end quote, that is to say, With the opposite quality, atamyata, the mind's energy does not go out to the object and occupy it. It neither makes an objective thing or a subjective observer knowing it. Hence, non-identification refers to the subjective aspect, and non-fabrication mostly to the objective. The reader should also carefully bear in mind the words, the origins of this idea, end quote, and not take the Vedic concept and imagery as representing the Buddhist use of the word entirely accurately. In the state of atamyata, in its Buddhist usage, there is no actual becoming or becoming consubstantial with a thing that is being known. It is more that the deluded identification of the mind with the object is being dispelled. One helpful way of understanding atamyata's role and significance is related to the other two items in the final triad of the nine insights as outlined by Ajahn Buddhadasa. The three qualities describe the upper reaches of spiritual refinement. Sunyata, which is voidness or emptiness, tatata, which is thusness or suchness, and atamyata, which is non-identification or not-thatness. The three qualities speak to the nature of experience when many of the coarser defilements have fallen away. When the qualities of emptiness and suchness are considered, even though the conceit of identity might already have been seen through, there can still remain subtle traces of clinging. Clinging to the idea of an objective world being known by a subjective knowing, even though no sense of I is discernible at all. There can be the feeling of a this, which is knowing a that, and either saying yes to it in the case of suchness or no in the case of emptiness. Atamyata is the closure of that whole domain, expressing the insight that there is no that. It is the genuine collapse of both the illusion of separateness of subject and object, and also of the discrimination between phenomena as being somehow substantially different from each other. As it has been written, and this is the third Chan patriarch, do not remain in the dualistic state. Avoid such pursuits carefully. If there is even a trace of this and that, of right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. End quote. So of the 10 obstacles or fetters that stand in the way of enlightenment, the penultimate is restlessness. In this light, we can reflect that atamyata represents the overcoming of this ninth fetter. The restlessness to which this refers is not the fidgeting of the uncomfortable meditator. It is the most subtle of feelings that there might be something better over there or just in the future. A feeling that that, which is out of reach, might have more value in some way than this. It is the ever so insidious addiction to time and its promises. This is why Ajahn Chah would say such things as, a samana has no future. Furthermore, if there is no that, then the nature of this must necessarily be reformulated so that we are not just left with a subject devoid of its object. Atamyata is the utter abandonment of the root delusion. One sees that in ultimate truth, there is no time, no self, no here, and no there. So rather than, quote, be here now as a spiritual exhortation, perhaps instead we should say, quote, let go of identity, space and time, or, quote, realize unlocated, timeless selflessness. Needless to say, the conceptual mind falls flat when trying to conjure up an image for such a reality, but that is to be expected. We are consciously leaving the realm of the conceivable, and the purpose of this book is to provide something of a map for those regions where the buses of reason and imagination do not run. It is also quite possible that on reading these passages on atamyata, the mind wants to grasp it as, quote, something to get so that I won't be so deluded. Rather than seeing it as a restraining of the habitual outward movement of the mind that comes as a result of disenchantment and dispassion. It is always necessary to be aware of the way that ignorance causes even the means of transcendence to become an obstacle if the mind does not handle it wisely. Perhaps one of the simplest, clearest, and most practical expressions of the principle of atamyata, not made of thatness, has come down to us from the teachings of Longpo Dun, a direct disciple of Venerable Ajahn Mun and one of the great lights of Dhamma in Asia in recent years. Here is his reformulation of the Four Noble Truths based on the depiction of ignorance as the fundamental error of the mind attempting to go out and pursue thatness in the form of perceptions, feelings, and ideas. In reflecting on these four formulae, it might be helpful to recollect the analogy of the grasping hand mentioned above, reaching out to become consubstantial with its object and then returning with it. So here's Longpo Dun. One, the mind that goes out in order, or rather two, the mind that goes out in order to satisfy its moods is the cause of suffering. And one, the result that comes from the mind going out in order to satisfy its moods is suffering. And four, the mind seeing the mind clearly is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And three, the result of the mind seeing the mind clearly is the cessation of suffering. Next, we have some words from Bhikkhu Nyanananda, picking up a variety of terms related to atamyata. Each of the words he outlines is worthy of a pause to consider and to contemplate its sense and implications. And, quote, the process of becoming is thus shown to be perpetually going on within the mind of the samsaric individual who identifies himself with sense data, under the proliferating tendencies towards craving, conceits, and views. This identification is implied by the term tamyata, of thatness, and one who resorts to it is called tamyo, one who is made of that, or is of that stuff. Since the perpetual process of becoming in the psychological realm is necessarily followed by birth, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, grief, and despair, in every specific instance of short-lived identification, an insight into the law of dependent arising provides one with the key to the entire gamut of samsaric experience. This penetrative insight into the arising and cessation of phenomena dispels all doubts as to the speculative problems of absolute existence and non-existence, of unity and plurality, etc., and the mind is brought to rest in the middle, though paradoxically, it now rests on nothing. Thingness has completely faded away, so much so that craving finds no thing to grasp at. Instead of an attempt at identification impelled by craving, a detached contemplation of the norm of suchness sets in. With this emancipation of the mind, one's attitude towards the world with all its vicissitudes becomes one of such-likeness, of aloofness, and he deserves to be called the such one or the such-like one. That, and this is a quote from the Anguttara Nikaya, that ardent one who touched the destruction of birth by overcoming Mara, by vanquishing the ender, that wise sage, the such-like one, the knower of the world, is unattached in regard to all phenomena. The discourse he is commenting on, the Kalakarama Sutta, is very brief, although highly potent. It is included here in its entirety. So at one time, the Blessed One was staying at Saketa in Kalaka's monastery. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, in this world with its gods, Maras, and Brahmas, among its population of recluses and Brahmins, gods, and humans, whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered over by the mind, all that do I know. Whatsoever is seen, pondered over by the mind, all that have I fully understood. All that is known to the Tathagata. But the Tathagata has not taken his stand upon it. If I were to say whatsoever in the world, all that I do not know, that would be a falsehood in me. If I were to say I both know it and know it not, that would be a falsehood. If I were to say I neither know it nor not know it, it would be a fault in me. Thus, bhikkhus, the Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing as apart from sight. He does not conceive of an unseen. He does not conceive of a thing to be seen. He does not conceive of about a seer. And so forth, through hearing and sensing and cognizing. Thus, bhikkhus, the Tathagata, being such like in regard to all phenomena, seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, is thus. Moreover, there is none other greater or more excellent than one who is thus, I declare. Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, or clung to is known as truth by other folk. Amidst those who are entrenched in views, one thus holds none as true or false. The barb which hooks and pales the world has been discerned well in advance. I know, I see, this is the truth. Tathagatas do not cling thus. End of the sutta. The terms thing worth seeing, hearing, cognizing, etc. are pointing to the habit we have of imputing inherent value or substance to perceptions, thoughts, and emotions. Without such imputation, they do not possess any such solidity or worth. Tradition has it that 500 of those listening attained arahantship, and there were 5 earthquakes during the course of this exposition. This short teaching also became of great significance in the centuries after the Buddha's time. It was used by the elder Maharakita under the auspices of King Asoka, his missionary endeavors to instruct the Greeks in their home country. All the various passages quoted so far in this chapter describe the nature of atamyata and its related qualities, but perhaps the questions remain. How is this best to be realized, and how can this depth of insight be developed? A text that points directly to this issue and one of the most useful meditation teachings in the entire Pali Canon is to be found in the Madhupindika Sutta. There, Venerable Mahakachana says, quote, "Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is sense contact. With sense contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With such conceptual proliferation, papancha as the source, the heart is beset by mental perceptions and notions characterized by the prolific tendency with respect to past, future, and present. Past, future, present forms cognizable through the eye. And then so too through the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. The solution to this cascade of trouble is, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendencies to lust, aversion, views, doubt, conceit, desire for being, and ignorance. This is the end of resorting to weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here, these harmful, unwholesome states cease without remainder. This is to say that if, with mindfulness and wisdom, the tendency to go out into perceptions, thoughts, and emotions is restrained, and one just allows seeing to be seeing, hearing to be hearing, etc., the whole papancha drama does not get launched in the first place. The heart then rests at ease, open and clear. All perceptions conventionally labeled as myself or the world are seen as transparent, if convenient, fictions. When there is insufficient mindfulness and wisdom, the mind goes out and attaches to its perceptions and moods, the result of which is the experience of me being pressured by life. Both an apparently solid self and a solid world have been unconsciously created, and the friction between the two is the dukkha that we find ourselves running from so regularly and ineffectively. Trying to find a me without a world that burdens it is like trying to run away from our own shadow. No matter how hard we run, the effort is bound to fail as the one form generates the other. The aim of all these teachings on atamyata is to show us that the dualities of subject and object, me and the world, do not have to be brought into being at all. And when the heart is restrained from going out and awakens to its fundamental nature, a bright and joyful peace is what remains, This is the peace of Nibbana.
I've used this yin and yang reminder to you as a contemplation until I thought my head was going to pop a few times. I've kind of shorthanded it in English in whichever way he conceives of it, thereby turns it otherwise. Right. I don't know if that's an accurate rendering by Jnanananda or not. That's what I kind of ended up sticking in my brain. But, initially kind of considered as whichever way you conceive of the object, this object is changing, but really the entire conception of the object is an internal mental phenomenon. And so that conception changes, but also additionally, the self, which it moves on to other objects, yes. And it reevaluates that concept. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so I kind of put this down in some ways because it can sometimes kind of become a papanchan spinning out itself. Is there any? I mean, it's part of the whole name and form thing I get into. Talk about. Is there any guidance in maybe like a particular place or it's kind of a tough thing to describe. I know it's a valuable reflection for me, but in a way, I kind of put it down because it's kind of too much.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually because it always comes back to dukkha. Mm-hmm. In terms of how we work with it, and sort of recognizing dukkha and cessation of dukkha, and so that it's helpful to have that because we believe in our mind so much, so that to have that refrain. Yeah, for however one conceives it, it is always going to be otherwise. Because the mind is always, it's looking for some place to hang its hat and create a reality. This is true. And to keep reminding oneself with that phrase is actually really helpful. But as you say, If it's based on conceiving, then you can tie yourself in knots with it.
I guess it just kind of popped in my head. Maybe you just hold it lighter in a way. Just as a, like... Because like you say, it's around food. Like, something you might think it's going to be something or taste a certain way. And, I often reflect on old advertising stuff. Like they have the classics form of... Is that, you can't video beer because it goes flat immediately. So it's actually lacquer often that they change the speed, but nobody goes, I really want a warm lacquer. After they see it during the Super Bowl. Yeah. See, but you don't know. When you look at food, you really have no idea. It's all reflections on your past experience. So just uncertain, maybe just like Ajahn Chah, uncertainty.
A lot of it is just sort of shining light on the process, just to sort of be able to recognize, say, how culpable we are.
Totally culpable. It's entirely.
But then the being tuning into that experiential realm of is this helping to release suffering or not? Because sometimes we can try to figure things out so much that it becomes suffering, even if we're correct. But the result is the mind gets tangled. And I think that's the recognizing that flavor of the teachings, trying to get us back to a place of relinquishment, dispassion, relinquishment.
I sort of use that same contemplation, and I would maybe use the word like trying to eat away at the trustworthiness of the mind, like how much I trust my perceptions in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, so trying to trust it less.
Yes. Entering Charles, where you see it. The mind is a liar and a cheat.
Use that one too.
And the reality also is that when we can conceive of something like a tummy, a time, sort of, oh, wow. Conceive as in that sense of, there's more to this picture than we normally see. Or even of those nine eyes that Ajahn Buddhadasa points to. Those are really helpful. Like a reminder, the tools that we have for reflecting on experience.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the Bahya Sutta sort of points to that. In the same way, it's only the same.
And particularly with the the Bahya Sutta, it's helpful to, because sometimes people try, pick up that, the scene is only seen, and then trying to replicate that experience of their being, just a sense experience, and forget that the sutta goes on to talk about how the sense of self is created, or how the self itself can be let go of, not forming a self. That's part of that atomiyata, where we're not formulating, we're not getting caught by the formulation of a self or an other.
Yes. It's like for myself, sometimes when I use a reflection along those lines, it's very easy to see the objective is kind of, okay, that's not really substantial. At least it's easier to put the label on it. But the instinct is not to want to turn around and put the label back to yourself. If you do start doing that, and then you're just kind of playing with the kind of the rapid fire sense data. Your mind keeps wanting to go ratify. It wants something.
Someone
to kind of rest.
Yeah, absolutely.
It almost induces restlessness or anxiety or like confusion. It almost feels overwhelming. Like there's just all the sense data. I don't know what to do with it. I just need to do something else besides sit here and watch it.
Right. That's where, again, that sense of paying attention to. Because it comes back to those four noble truths. Everything comes back to that, and that sense of dukkha and cessation dukkha. And so we have to see, because even really good tools, you can hurt yourself with them. It's like it's this great hammer. One of these great, those like Big Steve has, when he first came back to work this early in the spring, he's just so proud of this Japanese hammer that was perfectly balanced. But and it's a great tool, but you can still smash your thumb. So paying attention to, okay, what's the result as well? How are we dealing with it? So it should always be, we should be encouraging ourselves how do we find that place of ease and clarity and peace? And that's sometimes where you have to, set the contemplations down and just come back to the breath. Which sometimes drives you nuts as well, because I want to figure it out. But there's some things you can't actually figure out. There's the limitations of the conceptual mind. and it has to be seen.
You're kind of having a wholesome practice to turn your attention back towards.
Yes.
Getting
yes.
a little
unfounded
or just about ready.
The rendering of Lumpur Dun's rendering of Portable Truth sounded slightly different than what I remember you saying in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be willing to restate the Lumpur Dun's Portable Truths?
Well, I could, but it could be different again.
Okay. My recollection is something like the mind that goes out is suffering. The mind that stays with itself is not suffering. Mm-hmm. Is that in a nutshell?
Yeah, I mean, I think the... come back to the tie. Because if I remember correctly, sort of like the jitsong of dog is the so that the mind going outside of itself is the cause of suffering, and of course the result of the mind going outside of itself is suffering, and then the jit hen jit, so the mind seeing itself is the path leading to cessation of suffering, and the result of the mind seeing itself. So, in the sense of and it's an extrapolation to sort of say, it's not getting sending itself outside, but sort of saying how we actually frames it is a jit hen jit.
The phrase "beyond good and evil" kind of jumped out at me. And what is so the mind of Arhat is beyond good and evil? Is it saying what is good and evil? Is it kusala or is it some other concept?
Or usually in the way in Thai it would be boon and ba. Merit and demerit, detours, good and bad. Ajahn Chah had his own sort of formulation of that. That was one of the early books of Ajahn Chah's. One of the first books that we. He actually printed it. It was a phrase that was knocking upon, so beyond, like above cause, beyond effect, above good, beyond evil, above merit, beyond demerit, sort of thing. But it's, this sense of beyond good and evil, beyond those polarities.
But until you reach that, you still have to make use of the polarities, right?
Even after you realize, that's when you can really make use of it. Then you're not bound.